hundreds and thousands of years, people around the world have turned to the Bible for information about God. Two scholars, Mauro Biglino and Paul Wallace, argue for a radically different interpretation. Seeking out the root meanings of key words in these ancient texts, they find another, quite different story emerges. One with enormous implications for our understanding of the human race and our place in the universe. For more than two millennia, readers have interpreted the ancient texts of the Bible as stories of God, a seamless narrative in which God creates the heavens and the earth, botanical and animal life, and eventually, the human race. However, a number of anomalies in the texts, along with intriguing questions of translation, point to another possibility. Paul Wallace is an internationally best-selling author, researcher, and scholar of ancient mythologies. Over the last decade, Paul's work has probed the world's mythologies and ancestral narratives for the insights they hold on our origins as a species and our potential as human beings. As a senior churchman, Paul served as a church doctor, a theological educator, and an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia. Paul's work in church ministry has included training pastors in the interpretation of biblical texts. His work in biblical translation and interpretation has revealed a forgotten layer of ancient story, with far-reaching implications for our understanding of human origins and our place in the cosmos. Mauro Biglino is an internationally best-selling Italian author, researcher, and highly regarded scholar of ancient Hebrew. For many years, he worked for Rome's St. Paul Press as a Bible translator, providing with great precision the literal meaning of Hebrew words for Vatican-approved interlinear Bibles. It is an exacting discipline. The scholar must be rigorous in avoiding any kind of interpretation of the word and give only the literal etymological meaning of each word part. Mauro's findings set him at odds with the conventional expectations of the Catholic world and propelled him onto the international stage where his work has opened up a world of cultural memory recorded in the Bible. Yet hidden from the public for centuries by mistaken translation and the dogmas of the church. Together, Mauro and Paul show that the root meanings of a series of keywords in the Bible reveal an earlier layer of information very different to the story of God associated with the Bible. Hidden plain sight in the pages of Genesis is an even more ancient narrative, one which reframes the whole story of human beginnings. The oldest word in the Bible rendered as God is the Hebrew word Elohim. But is that what the word means? And what are the implications of the translation choices surrounding this mysterious word?
Hello everyone. It makes me smile a little bit to see this Bible tower that I consulted to prepare this video. It is a real pleasure for me to be here with my friend Paul Wallace to talk together about biblical topics. I will tell you about a very simple concept, but very respectful of the way of reading the so-called sacred text. Then we will start from here with a series of short videos with the aim of obtaining very simple indication for a respectful reading of the Bible, as respectful as possible towards the ancient authors. In this way, we could do an autonomous reading and we could get an idea of what the Bible probably tells us beyond what theology has told us instead. At the beginning, of course, I would also like to give you some indications relating to the absolute uncertainty that we have when we approach that text. I mean the awareness of the fact that we know very little about that text. To develop this topic, it is interesting to read some concepts expressed by Professor Garbini, professor at the La Sapienza University of Rome, professor of Semitic philology. Professor Garbini argues that Hebrew is a Canaanite dialect South Phoenician. Actually, Hebrew is one of the many dialects within the Canaanite languages. We only know Hebrew as it was reconstructed at the end of the first millennium after Christ, the so-called Masoretic Hebrew. At that time, the important thing was not to know the linguistic structure of those texts, but the theological implications deriving from the various currents of Judaism. This means that when we read the Bible, we do not read a text that followed grammar rules, but we read a text that followed an ideological path, and the grammatical rules were not a problem for the authors. This is important because over the centuries, many grammatical rules have been developed, for example, those relating to the term Elohim, which from plural, which is, must absolutely become singular. The linguistic and the grammatical rules have therefore been elaborated after. So we know only one of interpretation of the biblical text, that of the school of Tiberias, which produced Masoretic Hebrew. The Hebrew language in the beginning it was expressed through the consonants of the Phoenician language. Hebrew was written without vowels. We will never know how the Bible was originally read. The vowel sounds were introduced by the school of Tiberias between the 6th and 9th centuries after Christ. Da parte degli assirologi che si sono basati sulle forme recenti delle lingue semitiche. Professor Garbini says that when we speak of ancient languages, even the agreement of all scholars on the meaning of a term is not a guarantee of certainty. Based on this information, what we can honestly do is try to do a literal reading of the Bible. Regarding the term Elohim, in the face of all these uncertainties, I think the best thing to do is what I will tell you shortly. Elohim is actually a term that you don't know how to translate. For this reason, it is translated in many ways. For example, it is translated with the term God, but the Jewish exegetes themselves say that in the Hebrew language there is no term that indicates God as we understand it. As an omniscient, omnipotent, transcendent spiritual entity that is to be worshipped. Elohim is also translated as judges, legislators, governors, the bright ones from above, and so on. All these terms that are used actually indicate the functions that this Elohim performed, but do not say who they really were. The Elohim were certainly judges, they were certainly legislators, they were certainly governors, but who they really were and what the term Elohim really means, we don't know.
di Genesi 20:13, dove Abramo.
This is the fundamental thing. Since we don't know, we must have the correctness to say it. Here in Genesis 20:13, we see one of the examples relating to those uncertainties I mentioned earlier. That concerns the term Elohim and the verbs that are used. This is the passage where Abraham tells his story and tells when the Elohim brought me out of my father's house. Then you see that here the verb is translated in the plural form. This is the Bible translated for scholars who know the Hebrew language. This is the guide of the verbal forms present in the Old Testament, and also here it is said that the verb it is in the plural form in the third person. So it is certain that the verb connected to the term Elohim is plural. But in the Bibles translated for families, the verb is theologically translated into the singular because the term Elohim must indicate God, and so it must have the verb in the singular, even if it is plural in Hebrew. As you can see, the Bibles translated for scholars respect the letter of the Hebrew text, while the Bibles translated for families contain theological translations, that is, they must convey an idea, a different concept from what is written in the original Bible.
La Bibbia di Lutero, la Bibbia di Gerusalemme, la Bibbia concordata, la Bibbia nella versione di Giacomo, insomma la Bibbia inglese nella versione di Reggiano.
All these Bibles are translated for the public, and therefore they have the translation of verb in the singular form. Luther's Bible, the Jerusalem Bible, the Bible of the German Bishops' Conference, the King James Bible, the Septuaginta, that is the Bible translated into Greek, the Bible published by the House of the Geneva Bible. All this derives from the fact that Elohim must be translated with the singular term God.
Alcune che pongono attenzione al tema. Per esempio, la Bibbia dei testimoni di Geova traduce il verbo al singolare, dice e avvenne che quando Dio.
The Bible of Jehovah's Witnesses translates the verb into the singular, but in the note it says that in reality the verb is plural.
Fecero errare, plurale, per accordarsi con Elohim, che è plurale, che il verbo è al.
Various commentators from different schools try to explain why this plural verb must be translated into the singular, but each time they are explanations that always have the purpose of affirming that Elohim refers to the one God.
Plurale perché non se ne esce.
I don't want to go into the merits of all the explanations that have been worked out to try to prove that Elohim is a singular. To refute them, it is sufficient, for example, to take Psalm 82, which clearly speaks of an assembly of the Elohim, and follow what Professor Manuel Tov of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem says.
ma corrispondono in realtà a tre individui diversi. Tenere.
He says that the various ways used by Hebrew to indicate the term we translate with God actually refer to different people, and the terms are El, Elyon, and Yahweh. El is probably one of the singular forms of the term Elohim. The other form is Eloah.
Questa è, come dire, una radice che ritorna. Per esempio, in aramaico abbiamo, viene normalmente traslitterato.
In Aramaic we have Elah. In Syriac language we have Allah.
In
Arabic we have Ilah, to then get to identify the unique God with Allah. The Arabs say La ilaha illallah wa Muhammad Rasulallah. There is no God apart from Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. We still remember that even the Jews tell us that we will never know how the Bible was read because there were no vowels. As you can understand, all these terms, if they are considered without the vowels, they are all very similar. So we are faced with the same category of individuals, also from the point of view of the name.
Teniamo presente che quando l'ebraico è stato vocalizzato, Allah si stava diffondendo rapidamente nel Mediterraneo. E quindi chissà che magari certe vocalizzazioni. Allora, nel mondo del non sapere facciamo.
So we saw that from the point of view of the meaning of nouns, from the point of view of the use of verbs, from the point of view of uncertainties in the translations, we are faced with a situation in which we don't know. So, in this situation of not knowing, what we can do? A very simple thing. To read the Bible respectfully, I think it is right not to translate the term Elohim, the term El, the term Eloah. And when in the Bibles we have at home, we find the term God, we can replace it with the term Elohim, thus leaving the word used by the biblical authors.
Oppure potrà leggere il Pentateuco, oppure potrà leggere, diciamo, quantomeno fino ad oltre.
So we will understand that without entering into useless discussions and with the utmost respect for the biblical authors, if you read the Bible while keeping the terms they use, we will realize that we are faced with a Bible different from the one we are told, but a Bible much more fascinating, much more concrete, much more understandable, but above all, much more logical than what we are told. At this point, I give you an appointment here in the videos with my friend Paul Wallis, to address other indications about the most respectful way to read the Bible.
Portano a nulla, perché tanto non si sa, e non sapendo manteniamo rispetto per ciò che hanno scritto.
Ciao from Italy.
I'm very happy to be in conversation with Mauro on these topics because my own research journey in the Eden series have brought me to very similar conclusions, and it was initially the issues around the word Elohim, the plural form of the word Elohim, that broke me out of my old world of narrow Christian orthodoxy to a point of view from which I can see that the Bible is not a book about God in the way I thought it was, but it is actually representative of a kaleidoscope of entities from the beginning of the Hebrew canon to the very end. Now, the word Elohim is the Bible's oldest word that gets translated as God, but as Mauro has pointed out, it is a masculine plural form that takes plural verb forms. And as I began drilling down into those questions, I realized that the problems thrown up by the plurality of that word are not just a grammatical glitch. They represent an earlier form of the story in which Elohim was understood to represent a diversity of beings. There is a body in the Hebrew canon referred to as the Sky Council, in which a number of Elohim sit in council together. Now, in my Eden books, Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, and Echoes of Eden, I argue that the Elohim stories make better sense if we do just as Mauro just said, and read them with the word Elohim still in place, or if we use a root meaning, the powerful ones. When we read the stories that way, the stories change, but not in a random way. They change in a way that resolves many of the moral questions we would have over the Elohim stories, why such brutal and unconscionable things are done, how it is that human beings get slaughtered in the conflict of the Elohim, something that doesn't make sense if Elohim is translated in the singular as God. But the other thing that is revealed is that the moment you reread the stories as stories of the Elohim, the powerful ones, you quickly realize that you're reading the summary form of the source narratives from out of ancient Mesopotamia, the narratives from out of ancient Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. I sometimes get a knee-jerk reaction from people of faith regarding what I argue for in the translation of Elohim as the powerful ones. And the knee-jerk reaction is when people of faith say, ah, but wait a minute, we know that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So this is the Christian theology of the Holy Trinity. Surely that's why Elohim, the Bible's oldest word for God, is a plural. It must represent the persons of the Holy Trinity. Well, there are many problems to that reaction. And the first is that the Holy Trinity is a Christian doctrine. It's separated from the work and intent of the original authors by millennia. And the theology of the most recent redactors of the Hebrew canon was a monotheistic theology. They did not believe in multiple gods. And in fact, the insertion of the holy name Yahweh over earlier Elohim texts, such as we see in Genesis 3 or Genesis 11, reveals that that later redactor is turning the stories of the Elohim into a story of God. And it's those adjustments that throw up many of the moral problems. Why would a holy God genocide people? Why would a loving God bomb people back into a pre-Stone Age condition from having previously been a technological civilization? This is what we read in Genesis 11. So no, it's not a representation of the Holy Trinity. And would it make any sense for thousands of human beings to get killed in the crossfire between the Elohim? Is that what happens when the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit get into a spat? Of course not. No, the original stories are about something else. Elohim, what I would argue, are powerful ones. Now, some theologians argue that when the word Elohim is understood as the powers or the powerful ones, that it doesn't specify what kind of entities they are, that this word could refer to anything more powerful and advanced than humanity. And so we shouldn't draw specific conclusions from the word. T.N.T. Clark published a theology of the Old Testament, which was modestly titled The Theology of the Old Testament. It's edited by S.D.F. Salmond, and in it they quote the theologian A.B. Davidson, and he writes these words, "In contrast to men, angels belong to the class of Elohim." Now, I'll pause right there, because that's a reminder that the word Elohim gets translated in various ways through the Hebrew canon. In one place, it's God, and in another place, it's chieftains or judges or landlords. In another place, it's angels. How can this earliest word for God be so elastic? And why would the ancients choose a word to denote the unique transcendent God, but also denote random other entities who they never define? It's slightly ill-fitting. So the quote goes on, "It might be interesting to contemplate the question of how the same name Elohim came to be applied to God and this class of beings." Agreed, good question. Then he goes on, "Perhaps we should be satisfied with the general explanation that the name, meaning powers, is applied from the standpoint of men to all that is above man, to the region lying above him." That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? "Though the same name is given, i.e. to angels and God, the two are never confounded in Scripture." Well, that's a rather disingenuous thing to say, the two are never confounded in Scripture. That's a non-explanation of why the word can mean angels here, or false gods here, or demons here, or judges here, or God over here. What's the truth of the word? And that's why I argue for rereading the Elohim texts and leaving Elohim in the text, so that the shape of the stories becomes that much clearer to the modern reader. Another theologian who points to the word Elohim as representing a kaleidoscope of powerful entities is Michael Heiser, and he rightly points out that the word is far more elastic than we generally believe, but it's only a halfway explanation as to why that is the earliest designation for God. Why would God be categorized with archonic entities, other material beings? Why would there be this competition among Yahweh and the other Elohim? And it's clear in moments in the Bible, Yahweh classes himself as an Elohim. There's an occasion when his king wants a prognosis on his health, and he sends for advice from the Elohim of the people of Ekron. Yahweh gets furious and says, "Is there no Elohim here that he could consult, that he would run off and consult the Elohim of Ekron?" And it's a moment when you realize these Elohim are in competition with one another for hegemony. Go to the Ten Commandments and you've got something similar, where there's a great forgetting of the other Elohim being commanded. You're not to bow down to them. You're not even to depict them. You serve only Yahweh. And then Moses' successor, Joshua, says something very similar. Cut yourself off from the Elohim the Egyptians serve, and the Elohim your ancestors served on the other side of the river in Mesopotamia, and you should serve only Yahweh. So there we have a world of many powerful entities, but you serve this one. And so the Yahweh character is set among the many Elohim of the Hebrew stories. You also have stories about a sky council in which a number of Elohim sit in council together, presided over by the character Yahweh. How can you have a council where a number of those entities are fictitious, but the president of the council is real, and that's God? That's not quite coherent. We have to realize there is an earlier form of the stories prior to the 7th to 6th century BCE edit, and the original form is a world in which there are many Elohim, many powerful ones, all presiding over their own respective human colonies. Mauro and I are not the first people to point out the moral problems thrown up by reading the Elohim stories as God stories. There were some really significant church fathers at the beginning of Christianity who pointed this out very clearly and who were wishing to nudge the church away from regarding the Hebrew Scriptures as foundational for Christianity. That decision had already been taken in Acts 15, reading that book, and yet the arguments had to be had all over again in the first one, two, three, four centuries of Christianity. And Origen argued that if you read the Elohim stories as if they were God's stories and took them at face value, then you would end up believing in a God of whom you had to justify the most brutal actions. We would have to believe of God, he said, quote, such things as we would not believe of the most savage and unjust of men. So he pointed out very clearly there is a moral problem when you translate the Elohim stories as God's stories. I completely agree with Mauro that when the final redaction of the Hebrew canon was done in the 7th to 6th century BCE, the agenda driving that edit was an ideological one, not a grammatical one. And that is why you can have texts where the theological problem of too many gods has been cleaned up, but the grammar's a mess. The fact that the earlier grammar of the Elohim stories survives in stories where the name Yahweh has been pasted over the top is a clue that you're not reading the original form, and a clue that the original form had more gods or advanced beings in it than the current translation wants to give away. And the shape of the henotheistic world remains. The stories don't make sense until you realize there are many powerful ones in the picture in competition with one another. When Abraham gives this explanation of why he moved from Ur of the Chaldees, he says, the powerful ones told me to move. And we have the Elohim, the plural form noun, and then told me to wander is a plural form verb. Now, the plural form verb is clear in the Hebrew. So that survived that 7th to 6th century BCE edit. But what that information does not survive is the translation into English. Because you translate it into English and told me to is no different whether you've got a single or a plural subject of that verb. And so the translation into English hides the fact that Abraham is actually referencing many powerful entities. And this is why it's important to go back to the Hebrew to look at the translation of these words. This is the power of the work that Mauro has done, because as a translator of interlinear Bibles, he had to give a very precise rendering of each word in the Hebrew text with no interpretation, no theological orthodoxization of the text. Simply report what's in the text, and then you have the translations either side, and you can see I've got a plural form verb in the Hebrew, and it's been changed into a singular form word because the translators want this to be about God when it clearly isn't. I argue in the Eden series that when in the text the Elohim say, let us make the humans to look like one of us, they really do mean that. Look like is a very concrete term, and one of us is very clear. The plurality is emphasized there. If that word is translated as God, you've got a philosophical problem and you've got a grammatical problem. As soon as you translate Elohim as the powerful ones, the problem resolves. Elsewhere in Genesis 3, you have the Elohim arguing over how intelligent the human beings should be. And one of them says, we don't want the humans to be as intelligent as us. And once again, the conflict and the plurality of the language throws up a problem that even a child can recognize in the telling of the story from conventional family translations of the Bible. Those questions resolve as soon as you realize that you are reading a story about multiple Elohim conflicting over how intelligent human beings should be. Not a new story, it's actually a summary form of the conflict between Enlil and Enki in the ancient Mesopotamian stories. In my book, Escaping from Eden, I argue for the root meaning of the word Elohim as being the powerful ones, and suggest that when we read the stories that way, they make sense and they line up with their sources. There's a coherence to that picture which emerges. But if you don't want to follow that logic, just keep the word Elohim in the Elohim texts and reread the stories that way. And that's quite sufficient for a different shape of the story to emerge, a story that has something different to say about the world in which our ancestors lived, that gives different information about our origins and our place in the cosmos.
The final edit of the Old Testament of the Bible, the Hebrew canon, included the layering of some beautiful and profound theology over the top of ancient texts. Unfortunately, mistranslating traumatic ancestral memories as if they were encounters with God is a choice with far-reaching consequences. Belief in a violent, xenophobic, hierarchical God has been used through the ages to justify violent wars and all manner of abuses. However, the fidelity which the ancient manuscripts have been curated in the Hebrew canon by countless generations of priests and scribes means that in our generation we can now return to these fascinating artifacts of our prehistory and ask how differently they might be translated. To find out more about Paul Wallace and Mauro Biglino, along with links to their published works, follow the links in the video description. Thanks for watching The Fifth Kind. Please subscribe and click the bell icon so you never miss out on new content. For more thought-provoking programs, interviews, and documentaries, check out our website at fifthkind.tv.